I may end up on a more optimistic note than my colleague from Pepperdine. Is America still an exceptional nation? To ask this question is at once to assume that it once was and to question whether it still is. But it is also to miss the central question of what and may still be making, what made America and may still be making America exceptional. So perhaps a better way to proceed, from my point of view, is to go about it backwards. Let's confront the proverbial elephant in the room and speak directly to those things that must be leading us to question America's continued place as an exceptional nation. Is America's greatness and potential for greatness somehow diminished because of our current politics, which appear to demonstrate a giant leftward lurch? And is there something less great or exceptional in a people that allows for such a political development? To begin to answer these questions, we ought first to bind up the wounds of bitter disappointment and all inclination to pessimism, as some have already manifested at this meeting, and take an honest and hard look at recent events. Apart from the shifting control of Congress to the Democrats, the election of Obama, and now the passage of Obamacare, the largest and most significant political development of the last several years has been the spontaneous and largely unexpected, and in some quarters still unrecognized, emergence of the so-called Tea Party movement. Now, of course, this is not really a party, and it's not really an organization. That's what makes it so interesting. Whatever may be its excesses or flaws, the Tea Parties demonstrate some compelling facts about the underlying character of the American people, in my opinion. It is reminding us of something important about ourselves. Their manly and outspoken opposition to things that they take to be affronts to their liberty and to the bedrock principle of American government, consent of the governed, are things that demand reflection and probably also our admiration. More important, it ought to provoke some astonishment and wonder. How is it that these Americans stand up and call themselves Tea Partiers? How is it that after close to 100 years of the progressive project to transform America into something more like a European administrative state, a centralized government complete with an efficient and powerful bureaucratic elite substituting for individual judgment of citizens, how is it that despite all of this push and shoving and effort and a good deal of actual success on the part of the progressives, Americans continue to stand up and resist it? How is it that these Americans will not be pushed and shoved around despite this 100-year attempt? And I remind you, by the way, that the current president of the United States reminds us of this all the time. I'm going to quote here regarding Obamacare. He says, "I am not the first president to take up this cause," and he has explained the cause really began in 1912 and sometimes makes reference to even Teddy Roosevelt. "I am not the first president to take up this cause, but I am determined," he says, "to be the last." Not much of an argument, that. So how is it that after all these years, 100 year of effort, that Americans refuse to believe that the job of government is to take care of them? The distinctiveness of the American character, or even soul, if you like, is what deserves our attention and I need to touch on. However much the politicians and the education establishment, this is entirely to your advantage. It just got darker in here. However much the politicians and the education establishment speak to the American people about progress or the change in times demanding that we move beyond the outmoded views of our founders and the founding, ordinary Americans continue to revere the founders and the founding fathers. They continue to uphold it as an object of fascination and pride, something worthy of their attention and their study. When it is fairly presented, they buy books about it. by the millions. They watch HBO miniseries about it and continue, however imperfectly, to use it as a standard by which to judge the work of today's politicians. There is a broad and general sense among ordinary politicians, never mind the elites or committed disciples of the progressives, that these founders were statesmen with judgment who engaged the world, believed in great things, and they are worthy of both our emulation and their project is worthy of continuation. There is a broad and general sense that these men sacrificed much for their liberty and ours, and that this was something entirely unique and remarkable in the history of the world. This was not an accident. There is a broad and general sense that because of all this, we ought somehow to show our continued gratitude for their foresight and these sacrifices by being willing in these ways to emulate them. We must know and love our country, and we must work hard and be willing to sacrifice in order to preserve it. Conservatives have been quick to point to the flaws of the Tea Parties and to worry about the dangers of populism, and they were not and are not simply wrong to do so. However, there are some unmistakable facts pointing to a more cheerful direction that need to be remembered by us too. This is called a Tea Party. Their symbol or standard is, "Don't tread on me." I think that's a very cool thing. "Don't tread on me" flag. They invoke the founders in all of their conversations. I've spoken to at least a half dozen of such groups. And occasionally they even dress like the founders, which is, you know, somewhat silly, but maybe not completely. But, you know, Jonah Goldberg has made clear that in a recent column, I liked it, because he said that these people are not really revolutionaries. They're not revolutionaries, and sometimes they seem to talk as if they are. What they are is restorers. They want a restoration and return to something that they're trying to understand and then act upon. It may be that there are elements within this movement that do not understand what a return to the principles of the founding would really be, but they do sense it and understand themselves to be seeking it. They are open to persuasion and, in fact, demand conversation on these themes in a seminar-like student-teacher way. It's quite remarkable, in my opinion. But now we're back to begging questions. If the Tea Parties want restoration in return, to what do they seek to be restored and returned? In calling their movement a Tea Party, they offer us a clue. Above all, we are talking about people who feel themselves to be violated. They, like the original Tea Partiers, feel the sting of unwise and confiscatory taxation, and more important, they question the degree to which they might be said to have consented to these things. In short, they believe that the principle of consent of the governed has been or is in very great danger of being violated. In other words, they seem to detect a profound lack of attention to the question of public sentiment or public opinion in their elected officials. They detect it first in the selection of issues, healthcare as opposed to taxes or national debt, for example, and above all in the ugly and convoluted process that marked a successful push for Obamacare. The evidence of this growing irritation of the public with the lack of regard for their views can be seen in more than just Tea Parties, and perhaps it can even be seen in things that on their surface seem contradictory. In 2006 midterm elections and even the 2008 presidential contest, be taken as examples of it, these unmistakable expressions of the voters' sentiments certainly reflected dissatisfaction with regard to the so-called war on terror and also the arrogant abuse of power seen in a corruption scandal and the inability of the congressional majority to rein in spending. In short, it was a reaction against arrogance. Liberals and progressives at that time who accused Bush and the Republicans of arrogance were not simply wrong, of course. We may debate the relative wisdom and justice of the Bush administration until the end of time. What is not debatable is that it was ineffectual in persuading the American people that it knew what it was doing and that what it was doing was good, just, or necessary. Obama and the Democrats were the largest beneficiary of that mistake, but they seem poised now to repeat it. Like Bush, Obama explains that he will act first and persuade later. How remarkable is that? Unlike Bush, however, he cannot make even a semi-reasonable argument that this action without persuasion and consent was necessary from the point of view of self-preservation. At least Bush did that. Even worse, Obama's attempt at persuasion so far have more the feel of mockery and force than they do of elevation and of civilized, courteous conversation. He appears not to believe that we are capable of understanding what is in our own best interest or what is right or what is constitutional. These are not laughing matters. Speaker of the House's words in this regard to the contrary notwithstanding. This is just another way of saying that we are, from Obama's point of view, that we are actually not capable of self-government. Now, Lincoln's great formulation on public sentiment was this. In a democracy, he says, public sentiment is everything. With public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed. Consequently, he who molds public sentiment goes deeper than he who enacts statutes or pronounces decisions. He makes statutes and decisions possible or impossible to be executed. It is advice that both Bush and Obama should have heeded. But Lincoln also recognized that there was a right and a wrong way to go about molding public sentiment. Or to put it another way, there is a right and wrong way to get the people's consent. To understand this, however, one must first ask why consent is necessary. I'll try to wrap it up here. I'm running behind. It is not merely because it is useful or because a failure to get it will come back to bite you in the rear. Consent is necessary because in seeking it, political men demonstrate their respect for their equality with those Washington rightly called his friends and fellow citizens. Seeking consent is an exercise in political humility and reason, and a restraint against the temptations of despotism. In seeking consent, statesmen see the outlines of their own political limitations, and perhaps therefore also the limits of what can be expected from government, and even the limits of consent itself. The attempt to obtain genuine consent differs from mere pandering or demagoguery. It is distinguished by being an invitation to one's fellow citizens to shake off what Lincoln called a false underestimate of themselves, a false underestimate of themselves. And instead, he called them to rise to the level of equality, not only an equal political worth with their fellow citizens, but equality also to the task of self-government. This is not a leveling. This is an aspiration to reflection and choice and constitutionalism, which means that it is self-limiting. It is literally self-government. Recognition of our natural equality as men and under God is a statement both about our potential and about our limitations. It demands that we meet each other on grounds where we all have an equal chance to rise this level of equality, however unequally we may do it in the end. Over the years, and on too many occasions, conservatives, in their understandable frustrations with the progressive project at transformation, and in the seeming lack of clear thinking about it on the part of the American people, unfortunately have given in to the temptation to forget the centrality of consent to the original project of American self-government. It is this, and I'll conclude with this, abbreviating my remarks, the centrality of consent to the American project of self-government. Self-government is the American project, consent is central to it, and that is, so I'll put it in George Washington terms, use a word that Gordon doesn't like me to use. Washington says, in this way, then we will be able to establish the empire of civil and religious liberty. Thank you.